The bard William Shakespeare and his influence 4 centuries after his death. Shakespeare is hitting the road this year and traveling to all 50 states, including Maine. Not the man himself, of course, but his folio, the earliest known collection of his plays. One of the original editions of the folio, dating from 1623, is on display now at the Portland Public Library. The exhibition marks the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll learn more about the folio, and we'll discuss why Shakespeare has endured through the centuries, why high school students still study the bard, why Shakespeare festivals abound, and why we're still quoting the man. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. For some of us, the name Shakespeare immediately transports us back to a high school English class and talk of tragedy, comedy, and iambic pentameter. For others, those who remain fascinated with the bard, those are the people who plan their summer vacations around Shakespeare festivals. It's astonishing when you think about it that the work of this English playwright has survived through 4 centuries. Today, we're going to learn more about William Shakespeare and his folio that's on display now at the Portland Public Library. Joining me in the studio, Sarah Campbell. She's the executive director of the Portland Public Library. Don McAndrews is the executive director of the Monmouth Theater. And Ben Bertram is professor of English at the University of Southern Maine. Thank you all for being here today.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Of course, we would like to hear from you as well. When is the last time you read Shakespeare? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Sarah, what is a folio and why is it special?
Well, there is a folio is a certain type of book that has to do with how the paper's folded, but the folio, the first folio of Shakespeare, is truly a literary treasure, and it's considered really one of the top most important and valuable books in the world. So this is an incredible honor and treat to have this book in our midst right now.
My understanding, 9 years after his death, somebody gathered together all of his plays. Up till then, a few had been published here and there together and published it as a folio. There were a few hundred printed, maybe about 100 and something remain, and yours is one of them dating from 1623. Is that all right? Did I remember correctly?
The ideas are all right. The numbers are a little bit off.
Okay.
It was 7 years after his death. A couple of the actors and his partners in their particular theater group gathered together the what is really considered now a full version of Shakespeare's plays and published them together. And you're absolutely right that there had never been a publication before that time. And actually, that really wasn't part of the culture to publish plays in particular. They weren't considered literary treasures that were anticipated to have a life for 400 years. So it was really a very unusual exercise by these two friends and colleagues of Shakespeare. And I might turn to Ben, who knows really very much about how important it was and how challenging it was for these actors to pull this content together.
Okay, Ben. So back then, plays were really meant to almost be transitory. They were for the time. They were for an audience. Often, if they were written down, they weren't divided into scenes and things like that, right?
No, they were divided into scenes. Acts came later, actually.
Acts came later, okay.
1609. But to add up to what Sarah was saying, that was a great introduction. 18 plays appeared in the folio that had not appeared in quarto. At least we would not have them today if it weren't for the folio. So 18 of Shakespeare's plays,
including Macbeth,
The Tempest, Coriolanus. So I think that, in my mind, is the most significant fact, because there are quarto versions that we have. So quartos are smaller texts, and they were less expensive, And it wasn't until the Folio, as Sarah said, that 36 plays were put together. And it's a remarkable book simply for that reason, that that's why we have those plays.
And let me ask you this. Why do you think Shakespeare has endured? Why are my children reading Shakespeare in high school in 2016?
There are a lot of reasons. But when you mention high school, I think I can give one reason. I think we love Shakespeare's language. And, you know, Shakespeare has been taught in English programs for about 100 years. You know, they're English majors. We take it for granted that, you know, English majors have always been around or that people have studied Shakespeare in high schools. But that's actually fairly recent. But I think that one reason, you know, as an English professor, I can, you know, speak to his endurance. One reason we love Shakespeare is his language. And if you go back to, you know, the performances at the Globe, one reason people went to the theater was because they were excited about Shakespeare's inventiveness, his experimentation with words. You know, you take a word like fledge, you know, that had been used as an adjective to describe a bird, right? A bird that now has feathers and can fly. Well, Shakespeare used that word, I believe he was the first one to use it to describe human beings. You know, to be a fledged person means to be a developed or mature person. So a lot of people think that Shakespeare coined a lot of words, and there are some that he did. But what's, in my mind, more exciting is the way he took words and did new things with them. He changed verbs to nouns or adjectives to verbs.
And in fact, there's quite a bit of research that shows that as many as 1,700 words and phrases that we use very regularly now originated in Shakespeare's texts.
Oh, interesting. Sarah, how does Monmouth Theater, Dawn, how does Monmouth Theater decide which Shakespeare plays to stage each year? What is the conversation like?
Well, at the Theater at Monmouth, we are the Shakespearean Theater of Maine, and so our whole season is arranged each year around those two plays that we produce. Sometimes there's a theme in advance. Sometimes it's time for those plays. It could be something that's happening in our society. This year is our Vive la France season, and the two Shakespeares that we'll be doing are Henry V and Love's Labour's Lost. So we try and find things that are of contemporary relevance. At the same time, our mission is to produce innovative approaches to Shakespeare. So we look for the plays that maybe haven't been produced in a while, either by us or someone else. So,
what do you mean by innovative approaches? What do you do?
Well, there are we appeal to our audience. So there's always one play in our season that is traditional. And I don't mean necessarily pumpkin pants and hose, but something that is in what people would think an original production style. And even that is packed with a lot of dangers. In Shakespeare's time, they didn't necessarily use period costumes. They might use just the contemporary costumes, even if it was, let's say, a play that had happened historically 200 years before in terms of subject matter. So in terms of innovative, we look at the themes and the approach to the play, a concept to the play. So, for instance, this summer's production of Love's Labour's Lost will not be set in Navarre. It'll be set in the 1960s, and King Ferdinand has brought his court to Cambridge to study. So when they swear off women, they'll be doing it in the swinging 60s, which will add a little bit more sexual revolution to the dilemma the men find themselves in.
So will you just do that with costumes, or will you actually change the script?
Well, we tend to have a strong adherence to the verse. I think when you're talking about why Shakespeare remains relevant, it isn't because he thought he should set a play in Navarre. It's because of the language. It's because of the verse. And that's key for an audience. There are definitely some things that are anachronistic today that we might put in a play. There are also things that are beholden to a specific time and place in his language. So we occasionally might change a word or two here and there, but we try and really stick to what he's written and generally abbreviated for a modern audience.
Ben, what would you say to someone who is listening and thinking, you know, I get it philosophically, I know the quotes, I know about how Shakespeare shaped language, but Boy, it's really hard to read.
Well, I think, you know, a lot of the best things in life are difficult. You know, Shakespeare is challenging. There's no way to get around it. I think that Shakespeare can be incredibly valuable today as an author that makes us actually think more, you know, and pause and think about our words. And the difficulty, I think, I think what I encourage my students when they say Shakespeare's difficult, I'm not sure I like him, is to give it a chance, you know, give his words a chance. And I try to read lines slowly with them and to go through words very carefully. And I think they generally get very excited once they encounter these fascinating, rich words that, you know, no other author, at least I think from his day, is quite as good as Shakespeare was at that.
Some will argue that Shakespeare shouldn't be read at all, but only seen. Would you all weigh in on that? Go ahead, Dawn.
I that's something that's often said, that it was written to be performed. And I think that that's absolutely true. But I think that there's tremendous value in exploring the plays, whether it's by yourself. I think there are ways that are better than others to explore his works. And I think the idea that it's difficult to read is something that's happened in our culture and was not always the case. Shakespeare was part of our westward expansion. Shakespeare is early source material for minstrel shows. Shakespeare mining camps would have the complete works and a Bible. So I think that it's much more recent in the early 20th century, late 19th century, where we started telling people Shakespeare was hard. I'm sure we've all had experiences with bringing young people to see Shakespeare. And if we leave it up to them to explore the poetry and the rhythm, there's a very strong connection. So I personally think people should get out and see Shakespeare as often as they can. But I do think there's great value in reading it as well.
Sarah, you've had the folio on display at the Public Library for about a week now. What kind of response have you gotten?
Oh, we've had an excellent response. It's been steady, people coming. And we know that they're people that haven't necessarily been in the library or been in a library recently, coming in and just celebrating the fact that there is this very meaningful book there, but there's also a whole exhibit around it and all of these creative activities around it as well, which are bringing it to life.
Right. And we've posted on our MPBN Main Calling Facebook page the events calendar with some of the performances and talks and activities around it. Ben, what does the folio teach us intellectually? What did we learn about, for example, the difference between those plays that had been published in quatros and then were published in the folio? They weren't identical, were they?
Oh, no, definitely not. You know, one thing that people often overlook is that the folio does not contain plays that are the same as Shakespeare's original manuscripts. So we actually don't have Shakespeare's manuscripts. So the folios were derived, the copies in the folio of the plays were derived from a number of different sources. And so they're not exactly what Shakespeare wrote. And sometimes, actually, the quartos are, you know, many of us think are superior to the plays found in the folio. And, you know, that's often up for debate. You know, an example for me is I prefer actually the second quarto of Hamlet to the folio Hamlet. The second quarto is actually longer than the folio. And, you know, someone who just loves Shakespeare, I like to get as much as I can, you know. I think another interesting question is, you know, would Shakespeare have wanted to create such a book? You know, it was Ben Jonson who created a folio that included plays, and that was actually considered sort of a shocking thing. As Sarah was saying, people didn't think that plays were worthy of being put together into a folio.
Why would Shakespeare possibly have not wanted his plays put together into a folio?
Well, other playwrights, actually, Heywood is an example, said they had no interest in creating a folio. They kind of laughed at the fact that, you know, Jonson had done that. I think it's because they thought that their plays were, you know, headed for the theater. You know, they were writing for the theater. And their main interest was not actually in readers, and there really was not a large community of readers the way there is today of Shakespeare. But the folio helped create that, and one reason the folio is so important today is that, you know, we live in an age of readers, but that took a long time to develop. You know, where people would sit alone, read a Shakespeare play is a bit like reading a film script today or screenplay without going to see the film.
I see. Oh, we can only speculate what Shakespeare would have thought to have your students reading and studying his plays in a college course.
Absolutely.
One thing that's interesting, if I can just add on to that, is we're talking about the quartos as if they were officially published, and they were not officially published at the time. They were not condoned by the company that actually owned the content of the plays. A lot of them were pirated. A lot of them happened in very surreptitious ways. So they weren't official publications. And so to pull it all together in the folio was really quite a step. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we do have to take a break. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post our Facebook page. We're going to take a quick break. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Maine Education Association, a professional organization of public school teachers and support staff helping students realize their dreams.
The O.J. Simpson you've never met. The face of a batterer, the abuser, the murderer.
That's Sarah Paulson as prosecutor Marsha Clark in the FX series, The People vs. O.J. Simpson. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Paulson about preparing for the role, how her impressions of Marsha Clark changed, and what it was like to meet her. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock.
We know that many of you have choices in what you listen to, and many of you would prefer to hear what you want when you want. And while Maine news coverage is an important part of our morning edition, All Things Considered, and weekend edition programming, sometimes you just want to learn about what's happening between Kittery and Fort Kent, nothing else, but all at once and when you want. The answer is This Day in Maine, for streaming or podcast, available weekdays around 7 each evening at mpbn.net and also through iTunes.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're talking about William Shakespeare and his first folio. In the studio with me, Sarah Campbell, who's executive director of the Portland Public Library. Don McAndrews is executive director of the Monmouth Theater, or the Theater at Monmouth. I was saying it incorrectly. And Ben Bertram is professor of English at the University of Southern Maine. Join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now is David Greenham. He's an adjunct professor of drama at the University of Maine at Augusta and program director at the Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine. Hi, David. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Hello. How are you, Jennifer?
I'm great. I'm supposed to ask you about the Zany Majestic Bard program.
Yes, the Zany Majestic Bard is a program that the Maine State Library and the Maine Humanities Council have partnered to create, and it's going to be touring Maine from May 1st through October 31st, and libraries and other organizations can apply to bring it to their communities for free. There is a application form on the Maine Humanities website, mainehumanities.org, and the application is March 18th. So there's another week to apply, and the online application is very simple.
Okay, and so I understand you're a bit of a Shakespeare nut. Is that right?
I do love my Shakespeare. I spent a few years as the producing artistic director of the Theater at Monmouth prior to my friend Dawn coming on, and yes, I do. I've always loved Shakespeare.
Are you going to read to us or recite for us some of your favorites here?
I can if you'd like. I know that as part of the first folio, being at the Portland Library, the Theater at Monmouth is going to be performing Henry V on March 25th in the afternoon and the evening. And so I have a little bit of a famous speech from that show, if you'd like.
Go ahead.
This is right before the big battle at Agincourt. And Henry V says, He that shall live this day and see old age will yearly on the vigil feast his neighbors and say, tomorrow is Saint Crispian. Then will he strip his sleeve and show his scars and say, these wounds I had on Crispin's day. Old men forget, yet all shall be forgot, but he'll remember with advantages what feats he did that day. Then shall our names, familiar in his mouth as household words, Harry the King, Bedford and Exeter, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups freshly remembered. This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day. And then the English went and won the Battle of Agincourt.
Well, thank you. And I need to ask you, what does Shakespeare mean to you?
Well, my passion for Shakespeare actually began when I was in high school. And I grew up in Rochester, New York, and we had the opportunity to go to Stratford, Ontario, every year and see, at least twice every year, and go see different shows. And at that time, Stratford was a really major growing organization. And in fact, I was just watching the final Downton Abbey on Sunday, and I saw Maggie Smith play Rosalind when I was in high school, and there were wonderful Brian Bedford, who just passed away, some wonderful actors, and that experience was perfect for me. But I have to say, what solidified it was a college professor who actually touched on an issue that you touched on in this interview, and that is about whether Shakespeare should be read or performed, or as people said, heard. And I had a professor who said Shakespeare was only written to be read, and it was only by chance that it was performed. Now, this was before the internet and everything else, but I dedicated my semester to proving that this professor was wrong.
Well, on that note, we would like you to read, before we say goodbye, David, can you read us something else short?
Sure. This is actually a speech that's going to be in the Zany Majestic Bard, and it's not in the folio or really the canon, but we think it's the one of the a little piece of the text that probably is written in Shakespeare's actual hand, and it's from it's in the collection at the British Library, and it is from a play that was written by several playwrights called Sir Thomas More, and it's particularly relevant as it is Thomas More talking to a bunch of Londoners who want to burn down the houses of foreigners who've come and invaded London, and he says, "You'll put down the strangers, kill them, cut their throats, possess their houses, and lead the majesty of law in line to slip them like a hound. Say now the king, is he as clement, if the offender mourns, should so much come to short on your great trespasses, but to banish you? Whither would you go? What country, by nature of your arrow, should give you harbor? Go you to France or Flanders, to any German province, to Spain or Portugal? Nay, anywhere that not adheres to England? Why, you must needs be strangers. Would you be pleased to find a nation of such barbarous temper that breaking out in hideous violence would not afford you an abode on earth, whet their detested knives against your throats, spurn you like dogs, and like as if that God owed not, nor made not you, nor that the elements were not all appropriate to your comforts, but chartered unto them? What would you think to be thus used? This is the stranger's case. And this, your mountainish inhumanity."
Wow. Well, David, thank you so much for joining us today. David Greenham.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, adjunct professor of drama at the University of Maine at Augusta and program director of the Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine. We're going to start with our callers now, starting in East Machias with Chris. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yes, thank you very much. A couple of quick comments and a question. Firstly, I think of the line from A Midsummer Night's Dream, what fools these mortals be, and I think that could apply to some aspects of our presidential campaign. And secondly, the readability of Shakespeare that the professor brought up and that you asked about, think of the number of the people that read the King James Bible. And I find the language of that in Shakespeare sticks to my ribs better than a lot of writing. And my question is the recent movie Macbeth with Michael Fassbender and Marion Cotillard, I hope I pronounced the name right, I hope to see it soon. Does that work, or did they take liberties? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Chris. Has anyone in the studio seen it? No one's
Not yet. Not yet.
But that's a great cast.
Well, and it's interesting what he said about the presidential campaign. Again, one can only speculate what Shakespeare would have done with this spectacle, but I suspect he would have been writing to it. You're nodding.
Well, I think one of the ways Shakespeare is relevant, and that word comes up, by the way, and I'm not always that crazy about it because it suggests that art has to have some immediate sort of practical importance, you know, in social life. But I do think that, you know, I mean, Henry V is a very good example. David just read, you know, thinking about war and politics and what is a nation and when should a nation go to war. But Shakespeare has characters that I think really do speak to, you know, our political life today in all kinds of ways. And obviously it depends on, you know, what our interests are and how we read these plays. But an example is, you know, Shakespeare had a lot of very powerful female figures in his plays, very witty, very smart, Rosalind, Beatrice. And, you know, we have today the possibility of, and this doesn't necessarily play my, you know, open display my hand as to whom I'm going to vote for, but Hillary Clinton, I do think, whether people, you know, like her or not, is a very smart and witty, intelligent and, you know, a learned person. And, I just think when you read Shakespeare's plays, you see, you know, Shakespeare is presenting powerful female figures. And I think that, you know, some of those plays speak to us today because we're seeing in our own country someone like Hillary Clinton.
And one could argue more powerful female characters than are in the movies that are being, many of the movies mm-hmm. being produced today.
Absolutely.
All right.
And we had talked earlier about the power of Shakespeare's language and the persistence of the language that he introduced. But really, there are so many themes in Shakespeare that anyone can relate to, which I think is made obvious by all of the more modernized interpretations that have been made of Shakespeare plays. So love and jealousy and betrayal and loyalty and families and friends. And they're, all of those themes just are throughout Shakespeare's works, and we can all relate to those.
Well, interestingly, David mentioned that we're going to be doing Henry V at the library on March 25th, and our concept or our innovative approach to this when we took it on tour last fall to schools and community centers throughout the state is that our Henry is actually played by a woman. Mm-hmm. And instead of a band of brothers, it's a band of sisters. So we were already exploring that sense of leadership from a female perspective. She is the king still and not the queen. And how that has had, how it had an impact on the women, the girls that were in the audiences throughout the state and their ability, according to their teachers, to find a voice in that and seeing the band of sisters work together and seeing and hearing Shakespeare's words come through more women than men in the company was really exciting for them.
We'll head to Camden and Beattie. Hi, Beattie. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is pretty simple. In the discussion of whether Shakespeare is to be played or read, I don't know whether schools still do this, but I went to three different high schools, and we did Macbeth each time in different countries. And we all read them. We read them aloud. The teacher called on different people, and so we heard them. And the better the reader, the more understanding, the better it was. I just wonder if that's still done, because we basically heard Shakespeare with our own reading.
If only we could have David Greenham reading to everybody. We don't have educators in the room, but you do work with schools a lot, don't you, Dawn? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do think that there's a lot of different approaches that schools are taking and in partnership with arts and theater organizations across the country. There's definitely a lot of reading in classrooms that happen. I think that it depends on the teacher and their approach. So I think students are getting a chance to read it. More often than not, they're also getting a chance to get up on their feet. And that's one of the things we programmed as part of the complimentary events around the First Folio Tour, is that we have three different groups of students performing Shakespeare throughout the month that the folio is here. So there is an opportunity for them to get up on their feet and get that language into their own voices, and for audiences to come and see young people playing with Shakespeare.
And Ben Beatty was talking about high school, but at USM, do you have your students reading out loud?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I wanted to add to what Don was saying, and it relates back to Henry V and the First Folio. One of the really interesting things about the First Folio is that Heming and Condell, for the first time, divided Shakespeare's plays into comedies, tragedies, and histories. And Shakespeare had put out his histories, and they were incredibly popular, by the way, particularly Richard II, Richard III, and Henry IV. They had come out in quartos. They were individual plays, and they were showing episodes of English history. And when the folio came out, what they did was they put together the English history plays going from King John to Henry VIII as a way of sort of telling the national story, the story of England, and unifying that story. And one of the things that I do when I teach the history plays is I look at the folio and I look at, you know, that table of contents, that catalog that shows that organization. And it's very important for students to understand that, you know, the way we read these plays, I mean, the way they're taught, you know, has a lot to do with the way they're presented, you know, in what kind of material form. And so, for the last couple of hundred years, people have really liked that idea of teaching the history plays together as one big English story. But that becomes, it's a very political act when you do it that way. But I think that one thing I really like about the folio being here in Portland is it helps not just high school teachers, it helps university teachers, helps all of us to realize there are different ways of teaching Shakespeare. And I think it's actually very important to look at books and look at the material form that, you know, in which plays appear.
Can I add to that?
Yes.
Just that when the Folger Shakespeare Library decided that they wanted folios to go out on tour, which really is not something that they generally do, so that was a special celebration of this 400th year anniversary of Shakespeare's death. Part of their intention, and they partnered with the American Library Association and the Cincinnati Museum Center, and part of the intention of those groups was to require that there be certain types of programming at each of the places where the folio went. And one of the intentions was to have programming for teachers, particularly high school teachers, around how to bring the text alive with their students and to teach it in the best way. Other requirements of the exhibit or the exhibition were to do programming with children and families. And so the idea, again, was to help bring young people into it so that they could relate and enjoy and really grow to love Shakespeare. Additionally, there was an interest in having academic programming and then having large-scale fun events, which was really how we launched it when we opened it on the 4th.
Well, if you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566, our email address, talk@mpbn.net. We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Casella, committed to boosting recycling rates statewide through its One Bin, Zero Sort program. Casella, giving resources new life.
Wake up to the world.
Hello, I'm Dan Damon, host of the BBC's World Update program, and I'm here every weekday morning with all the latest global news, views, and analysis. From Tehran to Tokyo, wherever the news is, World Update will make sure you know about it. So don't let the world pass you by while you sleep. Wake up to me, Dan Damon, and wake up to the world.
And you can tune into World Update every weekday morning at 5 a.m.
And tune in this afternoon at 1 o'clock. All this week at 1, we'll be hearing talks presented recently as part of this year's Camden Conference on A New Africa. These programs are archived at mpbn.net. Today, we hear from Jennifer Cook, Director of the Center for Strategic and International Studies Africa Program. She'll speak on what are the U.S. interests in Africa and in what ways is the U.S. actively and effectively engaged. Speaking in Maine, today's speaker, Jennifer Cook, coming up at 1 o'clock here on MPBN Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, why Shakespeare still resonates today. In the studio with me, Sarah Campbell, Executive Director of the Portland Public Library. Don McAndrews is Executive Director. She is Producing Artistic Director at the Theater at Monmouth. Ben Bertram, Professor of English at the University of Southern Maine. Join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Sarah, we were talking before about how this was all started at the Folger Library, but with the partnership of the American Library Association, a big organization in Cincinnati. Here in Maine, this is not just a Portland Public Library event, is it?
No, it was a very exciting partnership where a number of us, I think when we heard about this exhibit, the light bulb went off over our heads, and so we pulled together pretty quickly. So the Portland Public Library partnered with the University of Southern Maine Libraries, with the Maine Humanities Council, and then very shortly thereafter with the Theater at Monmouth and Don jumping on board. And it has grown from there, so that we just immediately started reaching out as soon as we knew that we had been selected as one of the locations, reaching out widely through the theater community statewide, through the library communities. So it was wonderful to hear from David Greenham, and he spoke about this partnership between the Maine State Library and Maine Humanities Council, where we knew that even though the Folio is situated in Portland, we wanted the impact of this visit to be statewide.
All right, we're going to go to a call from Larry in Bangor. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm driving, so I may fade out. I have no trouble with quantum mechanics and Newtonian physics, and I've done elliptic integrals and Hermite polynomials and organic chemistry, but they translated the Bible from King James Version from an illegible thing to someone like me to something that is legible where I choose to read it. Has anybody taken Shakespeare and put it into a language that, as I sense, someone like myself who was unwashed can still read? Now, you don't want to change to be or not to be, but, you know, a lot of it's pretty convoluted to our modern tongue.
Larry, I understand there's a whole line of graphic novels based on Shakespeare, but maybe there's something in between as well. You were nodding, Don.
There's a project, actually, that's just been started this year by the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, where they have... they will be producing translations of all of Shakespeare's plays with modern playwrights and dramaturgs. 51% of the participating writers are female, and 51% are writers of color. And their effort is not to dumb down or to necessarily adapt, but to look at the language that was used in Shakespeare's time and do exactly what you suggested, Larry, make it more colloquial and more accessible for contemporary audiences, but still keep the verse. And I understand that one of the first productions just opened at Orlando Shakespeare Festival. It's been very controversial. If you look up the project, you'll probably see a lot of people responding both positively and negatively, arguing that it's the verse and the language that makes it Shakespeare. But it's not the first time in history that Shakespeare's plays have been changed, adapted, happy endings made out of tragedies. So there is something that's going to be available for you very soon.
We have an email from Dana. I'm interested to know, if multiple versions of a single Shakespeare play exist, how did we arrive at the version of the text that is now taught in schools, performed widely, etc.? For example, how do we know the version of the text of Hamlet that we read in school is the version Shakespeare would have felt is the truest to his original vision?
Well, the answer is we don't know. And I think we're actually better off recognizing how unstable the text of Hamlet is and other Shakespeare plays as well. You know, yesterday when I was giving a lecture at the Portland Public Library, I did a mashup of Hamlet in which I combined the first quarto, which is often considered the bad quarto, an unauthorized one that Shakespeare may not have written, the second quarto and the folio. And modern editions, most of them actually do conflate. That is, they combine the words from different texts, like the second quarto and the folio of Hamlet. You know, if quartos are available, that's always an option. So we're always changing Shakespeare. And I think that's, you know, that's an important thing to realize. And I think when people talk about being faithful to an original text, they're actually getting that idea goes back to the folio. That's the way Heming and Condell presented the folio, but they were presenting the folio as Shakespeare's original words as a marketing ploy. I mean, they did that so that they could sell books. I want to go back to also something Don was saying about the project of translating Shakespeare. I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing or that shouldn't be done. But what I would want to say is that people, you know, are often turned off by the difficulty of the language. But, you know, sometimes just the sound of Shakespeare is wonderful. And I really wouldn't want to lose that. And I'll just give you an example of a line that, you know, for a long time, I actually didn't know what it meant because in graduate school, I didn't bother to actually look up the words. But I just loved it anyway. And I think there's actually nothing wrong with enjoying Shakespeare like that. I'm not saying that that's, you know, where you want to end. You know, it's good to look up words and fully understand things. But Hamlet, at one point, after the murder of Gonzago is performed, that's the play that catches the conscience of the king, he says, "Let the galled jade wince, our withers are unwrung." And that's such a strange line, and most people are just going to have a blank face at it. But it's alliteration, and I just love the sound of those words. And I would not want to give that up. And I think that, you know, that is a danger. I do think that there's a larger trend in our culture of, you know, dumbing things down. And I think part of the problem is that people think they have to understand every word and that they can't enjoy the sound of Shakespeare. I mean, you know, there are all kinds of art forms in which we experience things that way. And I'm just saying that's part of the experience of Shakespeare. I'm not saying that that's the only experience.
Sure. Well, many people's first experience is as a student, and they feel as though they need to understand every word because they're going to be graded on their understanding of Shakespeare.
And I think that actually answers the question of whether it should be read or seen. I think seeing Shakespeare, hearing Shakespeare, you have the actor's body, voice, emotion, facial expression that help you understand those words. They may not even be in common usage today, but they help you understand and grasp meaning.
And before we go to a call, Ben, I want you to tell us what that means now that you have looked it up.
Oh, okay. Well, Hamlet's the galled jade is a wounded horse, and Hamlet says our withers are unwrung. A wither is the upper portion of a horse's back, and Hamlet is saying we're not wounded. Claudius is a galled jade. He's a wounded, you know, horse, but we're ready to go. You know, we're feeling good, and we're not wounded the way he is. So it's about using horses as a metaphor for talking about, you know, Hamlet's success in defeating Claudius.
All right, we're going to go to Bass Harbor and Andrew. Hi, Andrew. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just super excited to hear about how much conversation there is about connecting Shakespeare with young people. And I was really interested in Ben's recent comment about the different ways of teaching Shakespeare to different people. And that's been a big part of the work that we do here in Bass Harbor. I'm a co-producer of an organization called the Barn Arts Collective. And we make a lot of programs and performances based around Shakespeare for young people of all ages, and the response has been really impressive. It's been a real popular time for us with all of these programs. We have a piece called Shakespeare is My Hero, and that's for young people who are grades like K through third grade, and it focuses a lot on the design and the music and the disguise elements of Shakespeare in addition to the text. So we've had a lot of success focusing on not just the literary side of Shakespeare's work, but the performative side and the design side. We also teach a workshop called Shakespeare in Stage Combat. And so we focus on the rhythm and the breath of the language, but also the rhythm and the breath that has to go into certain Shakespeare and stage combat maneuvers And that's been a big part of our work as well. And then for older kids, middle school and high school, we do a full production of Twelfth Night that we've cut down to 90 minutes and tried to make as accessible as possible. So we do a lot of doubling, which plays into a lot of the gender dynamics of that play. There's four actors who play 13 roles, and everybody plays across gender. And then it's a modern dress production, so we've tried to include a lot of recognizable elements for young people in the show. There's a DJ, there's original pop music, the costumes are based on a lot of people that they might see on television. Or
great.
On the internet.
Alan, I really appreciate you calling in, and I invite you to put more, I mean, Andrew, really more information about your production company on the MPBN Main Calling Facebook page. I am going to move on to Alan, who's calling from Appleton. Hi, Alan. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm the organist and choir director at the Rockland Congregational Church. And every time we have a choir rehearsal, I always begin with what was called a meditation, but I will always read something like from Mary Oliver or Rumi or Frost. Well, anyway, a couple weeks ago, I read Winter from Love's Labor's Lost. And people just ate it up.
Well, that's a great story. Thank you for sharing it. Does anybody in our audience have a favorite, any of the guests in our studio have a favorite Shakespeare quote or something that you find yourself sharing with others time and time again? Ben?
There's so many to pick from. I think since we were just talking about Hamlet yesterday at the Portland Public Library, a speech like the to be or not to be speech seems to us to be, it's so familiar, you know, and it seems almost cliche, but actually very few people really hear the words or really think very carefully about it. But it has wonderful lines, like when Hamlet says, "Who would fardels bear to grunt and sweat under a weary life?" A fardel was a pack that a peasant would carry on his or her back, and it really shows just the physical labor and difficulty of life. And I still love that speech. But in saying that, a lot of people might say, "Well, you're an English professor, studying Shakespeare. Why would you pick that speech since that's the one everybody knows?" But actually, I think people think they know Shakespeare. But we can go back to, I would challenge people to go back to that soliloquy and really look at every word and look at multiple texts of it, the first quarto, second quarto, and folio, and find that it's very meaningful ways they might not have anticipated.
I'm not going to contribute a particular quote, but I just think that it is an interesting observation that Shakespeare wrote his plays for everyone. So when we're talking about the language, it wasn't that theater was exclusively for the wealthy, nor was it exclusively for the groundlings, the people that stood right up in front of the stage in the low-cost seats or lack of seats. It really was meant for everyone. So his language, his particular theater troupe was under the patronage of the king. And so his language really crossed all of the lines of society, even at the time. And that's part of what I think makes it so interesting thinking about it now. So the example of Ben's quote that's speaking to, the downtrodden at the same time that you've offered lines that are coming from the mouth of a king.
What about you, Don?
Well, I was just thinking about your earlier question in terms of the relevance of Shakespeare and why we're still performed today. And I think our language is peppered with quotes by Shakespeare. And so I don't think I have a favorite, but I do know that from the time both of my boys were little, they were quoting Shakespeare only because it's part of our language. It's part of the way we refer to things. It is required you do awake your faith. And I think the genius of Shakespeare truly is that it's accessible on so many levels, whether it's the storyline. You can look at Henry V or Henry IV and say they're history plays, but they're really father and son plays. They're about coming of age. I think Shakespeare's genius truly was as a plagiarist. He took other people's really kind of interesting stories and made them phenomenally interesting stories. So I'm a glutton for all the quotes and all the language and all the intricacies of the way he explored and explained humanity.
Okay, and you're nodding? You're nodding?
Oh, well, I agree. I think, Don's point that you know, Shakespeare's forte wasn't actually, you know, coming up with original stories. You know, a lot of people think that, but that's not the case. But you look at a, you know, a play like Antony and Cleopatra as one of the most famous sort of what we would call, you know, plagiarized speeches, and it's one of the most beautiful Shakespeare speeches, but he absolutely transformed, you know, his prose sources into beautiful verse.
All right. Well, that's going to have to be the last word. Thank you all for being here and talking about Shakespeare. We've again posted the calendar of events around the appearance of the folio at the Portland Public Library on our MPBN Main Calling Facebook page. So be sure and check that out. We will also post other information that was mentioned on the program today. Sarah Campbell, Executive Director of the Portland Public Library. Don McAndrews is the Producing Artistic Director of the Theater at Monmouth. And Ben Bertram is Professor of English at the University of Southern Maine. John Keimel ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.net. And today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at midnight. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.